Welcome to Love at First Science, the podcast designed to dig deep into neuroscience, the human body, and anatomy. My name is Celeste. I'm a physio and I teach anatomy to yoga teachers. And this podcast is an archive of the lessons I've learned along the way in my attempt to bring a more science-based approach into the yoga world. Hey friends, thanks for tuning in. Just a quick reminder that I don't run any ads, so this podcast can only grow with your support. If you learned something new that you found useful, please do rate and review the podcast. And if you think the content can help someone get out of pain, improve their life, move without injuries, or even just feel more inspired, please share it with them. It would mean the absolute world to me, and you never know, we just might help elevate our community along the way. You know, sometimes when I look at this podcast, I think to myself, wow, it's a lot of work. Is this a good investment of my time? And then occasionally I'll get guests like Dr. Ben Ryan. And suddenly I think to myself, this is so worth it. This is worth all the time it takes to put these together for you guys because people like him give me hope for the future. He's a PhD postdoctoral researcher. He works at a lab in Stanford. He talks about science on social media. Please, please follow him. He's so brilliant at making things, just mind-blowing things, so easy to understand, and for giving you a unique view and unique lens through which to view the world. I'm going to be asking him some pretty deep questions today around the topic of psychedelics. I'm going to be a little bit brave and tell you all that I'm a fan of taking hallucinogenic mushrooms. I found that they've really helped me become a better person. And I want to know more about the science, like why. And that's why I decided to bring Dr. Ben here to talk about this amazing topic. This episode has been broken up into two parts, and this is part two.
Yeah, and that's what you just mentioned is very common, is people describing this feeling of just becoming one with everything. And unfortunately, again, I really can't go into detail, but that sort of feeling and that experience is what I'm really studying myself, is how neurobiologically, systematically in the brain, how does that occur? You know, what sort of systems are these drugs acting on that make us feel more like connect, spiritually, physically, emotionally connected with another person, another being? Because that's an open question, one of a million open questions about psychedelics.
Oh, honestly, I've just gotten goosebumps all over because this is so exciting. What you're studying is so amazing. I know you haven't given us that many details, but even the little nuggets, I'm so excited for you.
Well, thank you. Yeah. And it's
it's great.
Yeah. I never really thought I would end up studying psychedelics. I guess that's how a lot of things in my life have been, is I never really anticipated any of it. It just happened. But it's funny because I've always been interested, like I said, in social interaction. And my PhD research was on autism spectrum disorder and looking at various systems in the brain and how they are altered and how that changes social behavior in autism. And now here I am studying, instead of the systems involved in autism, I'm now studying the systems involved in how these very unique drugs can change social behavior in the brain. And so all of my research can kind of coincidentally be neatly tied together in this idea of what systems in the brain are regulating social interactions. And it's lucky me because I've sort of just fallen into this, but it's exactly what I'm curious about. So
yeah, maybe it's very maybe cool. It's very, very cool. And actually, I'm so glad you mentioned autism, because that is quite a fascinating topic. And I mean, lots of people around the world either have a family member that's autistic, or maybe they have themselves dealing on the spectrum of some way, shape or form. What did your research reveal, and have you got anything interesting to share with us on this topic?
So my research was looking at a very specific genetic risk factor for autism. And it's probably not interesting to most people, but essentially what we found is that in a particular brain area called the prefrontal cortex, which is right here behind your forehead, and it's very involved in a lot of the things that make us very advanced and human. You know, it's involved in working memory, like a lot of high level cognitive tasks, but it's also involved in social cognition. And so, making decisions in the context of social settings and understanding another person's state. And what we found is that all of my research was done in mice, because with mice, we can induce these same genetic mutations that are associated with autism in human beings. And in many cases, in the case of my study, we found it that the mice actually show changes in social behavior. So we can get a sense that the same sort of systems are affected probably in the mice. And the reason we do this in the mice is because we can then really interrogate the brain systems that are involved. And so what we found essentially was that the neurons in the prefrontal cortex were actually hyperactive in this model. And I traced it to a very specific molecular system, this molecule of protein called NPAS4. And basically we found that by turning down the activity of those neurons in the frontal cortex, the mice actually became more social. And so all in all, we basically found this system that regulates sociability that is altered in autism. Whether or not it regulates sociability outside of the context of autism, we're not sure. But that and a couple other papers were all my PhD research, and they all kind of come down to like different changes in the brain associated with different genetic risk factors.
I mean, you're so clever. I hope you know that. I hope you know how clever you are. And I mean, you've like isolated genes in brains. I mean, that's it's so far from my everyday world. So I'm just in awe that you actually do this for a living. Talking about the prefrontal cortex, I mean, we're on social media quite a lot. And I'm just wondering if you kind of studied or you know of any social media, how social media might influence areas of our brain that actually do deal with rational thinking. Because I mean, I have a social media platform. I don't know if you ever experienced this, but sometimes it does warp my sense of reality. And I know you put a post out recently about how taking a break is really healthy for your brain. Can you just give us a little bit more about Dr. Ben Ryan's 101 strategies on managing the madness that is social media?
Like you mentioned, I posted a couple of weeks ago a video saying that there was a clinical trial, very interesting that it was called a clinical trial, where the intervention, normally in a clinical trial, it's a drug. In this paper, it was 1 week break from social media. And so they found that when people did this, you know, I think they had 150 people total, I think. So 75 in the control group, 75 in the 1 week off group. And after the week off, the people in the break group showed improvements in depression scores, anxiety scores, or reductions in those scores, and improvements in well-being scores. And so I posted about that. And frankly, I have a few more posts in my drafts that I'm ready to
Amazing.
Go. But I don't want to hammer out like too much anti-social media all at once. But, you know, I think we, modern society is incredibly different from any past society in that we've developed this thing that is just so incredibly captivating that we can hardly look away from it. And if we look at our screen time, you know, most people, I don't know what my screen time is. It's probably like 5 or 6 hours a day, which I don't even know how that's possible. It makes me sick thinking about it.
I'm with you. I'm not judging. I'm 100% there. And it really, really bothers me.
Yeah. And it's just one of the videos that I'll preview is this, this neuroscientist, Matthias Brand, published a few months ago in Science, this sort of commentary about whether or not social media can actually be addictive. And his claims or his sort of arguments are that social media acts upon all of the brain systems that are inherently rewarding, like social connection and, you know, social reinforcement and sex and money and goods. You know, all these things, like when you're scrolling on social media, it's just, you know, depending on what your feed is, it's probably a person of the opposite sex in a bathing suit dancing, you know, and then it's something that you really, really want to buy. And here it is advertised for you. And then it's someone you really like talking about something you really care about. And it's just like reward after reward after reward.
You've hit the nail on the head. I didn't even think about it like this.
And he also points out that there are changes happening with the psychiatric diagnostic manuals, where they're beginning to, or at least they're considering incorporating like addictive diagnoses related to internet use and social media use. And so some people have been sort of diagnosed or classified with harmful social media use. And those people actually show the same changes in the brain that are associated with drug addiction. And so they're showing actually a reduction, if I'm pretty sure, I don't want to butcher this. And, you know, I'm all about not spreading misinformation. So I hope I'm right on this. But I'm pretty sure they show reductions in parts of the prefrontal cortex that regulate this, you know, decision-making and planning, and also that specifically allow you to disengage from behaviors. And I think social media is not like smoking cigarettes where you're going to become addicted all the time, but for those who may be vulnerable to those types of like hyper rewarding scenarios, especially when they have stress going on in their life and social media acts as an escape, you know, I think that it can be potentially not dangerous, but you know, it can lead people into unhealthy habits where they're spending too much time on their phone. And so, you know, in general, I just think one of the things I say in one of these upcoming videos is, you know, if you had existed since the dawn of humanity and you had seen everything that humans had gone through and all the rise and fall of civilization and the changes in technology, and you now saw modern humans and how we all walk around buried in our phones and we come home and we sit on our phones. It almost feels like a sci-fi movie, like Time Machine, where at the end of the time, well, I don't want to spoil it for anyone. End of the Time Machine, he goes in the future and like humanity has divided into like beast and like highly intellectual, if I remember correctly. And it almost just feels like we're so intelligent, but we're intelligent enough to hijack our own systems with these captivating distractions that distract us from doing the things that we are so highly capable of. And so instead of, you know, exploring space, of course we are doing that still, but doing amazing things, most of us are just spending our time swiping away on social media, and that just seems like such a tremendous waste of such an advanced civilization. I find it's very interesting and a little bit painful to think about.
I agree. I mean, when my partner and I talked about having kids, I was like, to be honest with you, it's like a big reason for us not to have kids is because I just look at how kids are now, and there's so much, it's like the allure of technology is so powerful. And we're now going to go into this whole VR thing. I can't see how a parent could stop them. It's very difficult without being like this big bad guy, and yet still preserving that desire to want it to be outside and really engage with the real world. And then, you know, I find psychologically what's really challenging for me is my work is tied to that. My earning a living is tied to being on social media. So then that really messes with your head, because you're like, oh, if I haven't done X, Y, and Z, and I haven't engaged with other people, and I haven't, you know, made enough posts, then I'm not going to have enough money to buy food and pay my rent. So it's a weird headspace.
Yeah, being a creator definitely has changed my interaction, my relationship with social media. And, you know, this only appeals to a very select group of those listening, but what nowadays, when I open Instagram or Twitter or TikTok, whatever it is, I just feel stressed. I immediately just feel stressed that it used to be an escape. And for most people, that's probably what it is. You're waiting and you're bored, or you got whatever, you're laying in bed and you're just swiping away and you're just killing time and you're mindless. But being a creator, it's different, because you open the app and it's like,
I've got to get ideas and like I've got to save audios.
Right, exactly. It becomes work. It really becomes work.
It is.
Luckily for me, at least, that has been enough reason for me to basically disengage. And so I essentially don't use social media unless I'm posting or doing something, you know, I'm commenting on my post and answering questions and DMs and things like that. I don't know. I've kind of come to this weird place where I like, no, thank you. I don't want social media.
Honestly, it's so refreshing hearing you say that, particularly because you are someone with a platform, B, because you study the brain. And you obviously know what you're talking about. Apart from disengaging in that way, have you got any other tips for helping people just make sure they manage their minds around this madness?
Yeah, I mean, and I should clarify, you know, I don't think that social media is like evil or brain poison or anything like that. I just think that it can be a distraction that can lead to unhealthy habits. And so I guess really, you know, my best piece of advice, and this is based on no neuroscientific evidence, this is just me as a human being, I just think, like, be more mindful about your usage. And, you know, there are apps where you can, I think you can, like, set a timer or put, like, a guarder on your usage.
I use one of those.
Yeah. I mean, just if you need one of those, if you want to use one of those, go for it. If not, I mean, maybe just when you're using social media, especially with something like TikTok or Instagram, it's so easy to get lost. And I've heard a lot of people I talk to say, oh, I had to delete TikTok because I was spending way too much time on there. It's quite hijacking. It can be, at least for those reward circuits, I suppose, where people fall into a hole and spend hours on there. So, you know, just as best you can, if you're on there and you're watching videos, every couple of minutes, just try to, like, snap out of it and look away and think, oh, okay, what time is it? Do I really want to spend all this time sitting here doing this? Am I going to look back on this and say, what the heck happened to my Thursday afternoon? I spent the whole time on TikTok, you know? So just be mindful about it. Also be mindful about how you're using it and how it's affecting you. You know, if you're using it to escape painful stuff happening in your life, you know, think about whether that's doing you any good. And it social media should be something that we open for a little bit of fun or killing time, you know, but it shouldn't be an escape from reality. And it shouldn't be somewhere that you spend all of your time. Because, you know, this is, again, just my opinion, but there's a whole world out there and you know, there's a lot to do and a lot to see, and social media feels like it gives you access to all of that, but it really doesn't. It just gives you a phone screen, you know, that makes you feel like you're elsewhere. So, you know, don't forget to disengage when you're not getting anything out of it and to consider how it's affecting you.
Hey, my loves, real quick, if you are hypermobile, be sure to check out my book, Too Flexible to Feel Good, where my co-author and I share the latest science on how to help a bendy body feel awesome. If you already have the book, please do leave it an Amazon review. It helps more than you could ever know, and it just might help someone else feel a bit more stable in their bodies. The book is called Too Flexible to Feel Good, and you can get it from most online retailers.
Word that you used quite a lot while you're talking just then was mindfulness, and it kind of full circle back to our original question, which we started the interview on, which was about yoga and mindfulness, you know, and how maybe, just tuning in a little bit more, trying to figure out, like, this, if we're really present in the moment, we probably get the answers we're looking for. Mm-hmm. But we're going to digress, because one of the things I've been really drilling into my following over the last few weeks has been about the topic of pain. Because obviously pain, you know, for a long time we've taught it's like this thing that goes into your brain to kind of signal that something's wrong or something's damaged or hurt. And then I came across the work of Lorimer Moseley. It's been a long week. I can't speak, guys. Lorimer Moseley, who is the leading pain researcher in the world. I bought his very expensive book, Explain Pain Supercharged, which was about £180, which is a lot of money. But considering how much work has gone into this research, I thought, okay, listen, I'm just going to do it because it's a topic I'm fascinated by. And then we started learning about how pain is this output. And I was like, wow, like the contrast on what we've always been taught and how that shapes our reality when you know this information. I know you've got some really cool things about pain that you've recently shared. Can you give us some of your most favorite things to tell the listeners?
Yeah, that's an expensive book right there.
Really, I was like handing over the credit card, shaking.
Yeah, like, oh, please be worth it.
I like pain a lot, okay? I really needed the book.
Yeah, well, hey, the price of education, you know. The work that I've mostly focused on and learned about and spoken about is about empathy for pain. And there is just some unbelievable research out there that I never knew existed until recently. And it just completely blew my mind. There's many levels to this, and I'll try to walk through it properly. So first things first, there are systems in the brain that are very much indicated in empathy. And so when you see someone that's in pain, there are brain areas that that consistently light up and that have been associated with empathy in general. But what's interesting is that many of those brain areas that are activated by observing someone in pain are the same brain areas that are activated by experiencing pain yourself. And so there's this sort of theory or idea called the perception action model, where if you've ever heard of mirror neurons, you know, this idea that you have brain cells that activate within you when you see someone do something that mirror that experience. This is sort of like the idea of the perception action model, where it's by seeing someone experiencing something and your brain modeling that experience in you, you can therefore understand what they're going through. And it happens rapidly, and it happens almost unconsciously and naturally. And I'm interested in this because, like I said, I'm curious about social interaction. And so to me, this is a remarkable feat of social interaction, where if you're working in groups and you just look at someone and without even having to do any work, you can immediately feel what they're feeling and understand what they're going through. That is super, super valuable and useful for survival and for working in groups. But where this gets really interesting is that if you give someone painkillers and you have them look at someone else in pain, they report that the other person is experiencing less pain. Like it sort of blocks their empathy for someone else's pain. Of course, painkillers block your own pain, but it also blocks to some level your ability to identify with another person's pain, which is really interesting and really supports the idea that it's your brain is sort of modeling the experience of the pain. And, you know, we can also think about this, like if you see someone, any sort of injury, you witness someone, I don't know, for a guy, there's a very particular thing. If you see someone getting hit in the groin, it's like, oh, you know,
yeah. Hurt.
Yeah. It's like that discomfort. It's like, why does that hurt so much? Well, it may be because your brain is modeling the experience to some level of how uncomfortable that would be. But this goes another level further and becomes unbelievable. Two more levels, actually. First off, if you give someone a fake painkiller and it's a placebo, but you tell them it's a painkiller, it still blocks their empathy for someone else's pain.
This is so crazy.
Which is just...
I just can't even deal with that.
It's just getting so far-fetched.
The Matrix.
Yeah, it's like when I found these studies, I was genuinely, it was hard to believe that it was real neuroscience. It seems like something that you would hear about like in a book. Maybe not some people, they're like, well, duh, no, it doesn't. I don't know. For me, it sounds ridiculous. But the most incredible thing, and I had a video about this that went viral. If you give someone this placebo painkiller and you show them someone in pain, it blocks their empathy for that pain. But if you give them, on top of the fake painkiller, a real drug that blocks your natural opioid receptors. So in opioids, you know, they act on these receptors and they cause pain relief. So if you block those natural opioid receptors, it blocks the placebo's ability to block your empathy for pain, so it's kind of confusing. But what it suggests...
Whoa. So the thing that it was doing, it no longer doing, if you take the very, very, very strong painkillers, which is morphine.
Oh, sorry.
Opioids.
Yeah, so no. There's no opioids taken. So if you block those receptors, that opioids... So we have endogenous opioids. Because when you
they're
take
in there already.
yeah. Sorry. Endogenous means, yeah, existing internally or naturally. Yeah, when you take opioids, they bind to these opioid receptors that exist in our bodies, in our brains. But the reason those opioid receptors are there is because we also have opioid-like molecules that are in our brain that bind to those to cause pain relief in our brain. Or at least as a result of binding to those receptors, we feel less pain. And so when they blocked those receptors in the brain of someone, and they didn't give them any real painkillers, they gave them a fake painkiller, it blocked the empathy for someone else's pain, which means, to make this more clear, that when they gave someone the placebo painkiller, the brain was activating its own naturally existing pain relief systems. And when they blocked those natural pain relief systems, the placebo painkiller no longer did anything. So just by believing that they were getting painkillers, their brain started actually activating these naturally pain relieving systems in the brain, which therefore made them feel less empathy for someone else's pain.
I'm very confused and simultaneously fascinated. A quick question though. So does that mean that if somebody is on long-term analgesics, that's going to limit their ability to have empathy?
We don't have clear data suggesting that, but theoretically, it could. I mean,
wow. And that could obviously impact how their social interactions could evolve because, I mean, if a person feels that you aren't empathetic to what they're going through, they might socially distance themselves from you.
Right. I mean, the general idea is that it's difficult to empathize with someone who's going through something that you can't relate to. And so if they're going through pain and you've taken a painkiller, you can't really relate to that experience. So you feel less bad for them. And so there's also examples of this where those who were born with conditions where they can't feel pain, they also feel much less empathy for someone else's pain because they just can't relate to it. And so, it's, you know, that makes sense because you think about, you know, someone who has, if I was shown a video of a woman delivering a child and, you know, I could tell that she was not in a good way, she was not happy about it. You know, she's experiencing pain, discomfort. I would probably empathize with it, but certainly not to the same level that a mother would, you know, someone who has gone through the experience and experienced it themselves. Or, you know, if you show someone a picture of a hand being slammed in a door, you know, you think, ooh, no thanks. You know, I don't like that. It's uncomfortable. But for someone who had a really bad experience with that same incident, they would probably feel even more, you know, discomfort. And so it's really the idea that being able to relate to a experience really is what drives empathy for that. And there's also this sort of it's called cognitive empathy, which is when you intentionally work to put yourself in someone else's space, you know, by asking yourself, what would it be like to feel that, you know, what would it be like to be that person? And, you know, an aside, I think that on social media, that natural sort of emotional empathy that we feel, like I said, you see someone in pain or you see someone experiencing something, your brain automatically kind of models that state. I think that is sort of absent on social media, which may be why there's so much harassment and, you know, a lack of empathy. There's a lot of mean stuff happening on social media. I think, unfortunately, a lot of people have experienced some degree of harassment or bullying or something on social media. And it seems like there's a much lower threshold to that where people will just kind of lash out in situations where they wouldn't normally do so in person and face-to-face interaction. Yeah. So I think that natural automatic form of empathy is kind of blunted on social media, but the cognitive empathy where you can intentionally put yourself in someone else's shoes, that is entirely possible still. You know, you're scrolling on Facebook and you see someone says, oh, I was in a car accident, you know, and they post a picture of them in the hospital and you think, oh my gosh, how horrible. You know, I feel so bad for this person. And I think that's really acting on that cognitive empathy. It's, you know, assuming trying to think about what it would be like to be in that position. And yeah, so empathy for pain is such an interesting topic. And
it's fascinating. It's fascinating, isn't it? I mean, all the things you're just talking about, I'm like, unbelievable. Because of time, we have to start wrapping up. And the question I ask all the guests at the end is, if you had one message for the world, it doesn't have to be related to anything we spoke about. It can be anything that you just wish more people around the planet were doing so it could be a better place. What would your message be?
Well, it does relate to what I was just saying. I would encourage everyone to try your hardest to put yourself in other people's shoes and imagine what life is like for them. You know, if it's a stranger, you never know what someone's going through. You know, sometimes I'll walk by someone and I'll think, you know, my first impression might be, whoa, that person looks, you know, a little scary, or there's something wrong with that person. You know, like I have this impulse to think that. And then I think they could be going through the worst day of their life. I have absolutely no idea. Like the very least thing I could do is hold the door for them, you know, and they might be going through something terrible. You never know what people are going through. Always just try to live life with a bit of empathy and assume that those around you could benefit from even the mildest amount of kindness that you could provide them. And I think if everyone kind of lived that way, the world would be a lot more beautiful and pleasant.
This is probably one of the best messages for the world I've been given on the show. Thank you for sharing that. There's that beautiful quote, kindness is something that the blind can see and the deaf can hear. And I always get a little bit emotional when I quote that, because it really is so, so true. Thank you so much for coming on the show, for giving up your precious time. I know you've got so many spinning plates, and to listen to you talk so eloquently about the brain, about research and science, is such a privilege. Where can people find out more about you?
Well, thank you so much again for having me and for the great discussion. Easiest place to find all my anything is my website, just my name, benrein.com, BENREIN.com. And all of my social media is on there. My research papers are on there. If you want to download them and read them, it's all free. There's no paywalls. I even have resources on there for students. I think that's it. More about my research itself. So yeah, please, if you're interested, feel free to reach out through there. I think there's like a chat box kind of thing. And I appreciate your interest, and thank you so much again for having me. It's been very, very interesting and a great conversation.
I couldn't agree more. Thank you so much. It's been absolutely amazing.
Thanks for listening, everyone. That was part two. Next week, we'll be welcoming a new guest. Remember, if this episode was helpful at all, please do share, rate, and review.